to this month's subject of thinking outside the box. And the relevance of thinking outside the box is novel and new approaches to cancer treatment. Definitely thinking outside the box rather than a deterministic viewpoint of killing cancer cells. So people that are listening to the show tonight who either have or know people who have diagnoses of cancer, could be very relevant to those people listening, and I'd encourage you to call in with any questions that you might want to put to either myself or Dr. Pete about this month's show. So, cancer then has traditionally been viewed as something to destroy, and to this end, the mainstream of treatment is either what's known as cytotoxic cell-killing drugs, which poison the body, or this directed focused radiation, which does no better. It's all cidal, that is, it kills the cells directly, with also the associated collateral damage and inflammation that comes from the treatment, either widespread or localized. Now, the evolution of thinkers who challenge dogma has always hailed new breakthroughs in our understanding, and novel approaches to cancer treatment are also making themselves known. The co-discoverer and Nobel Prize winner James Watson recently made some observations regarding cancer and its treatment, and these have again been taken further, and a very much outside-the-box theory has emerged. And Dr. Pete, then, he joins us in a moment here. We'll be asking him for his viewpoint on it, because he's very much an outside-the-box thinker, as most of you perhaps who've tuned into him have recognized. Now, most people are under the mistaken belief, and myself included, that antioxidants are always good for you in the diet, the more the better. But this is not true, and sometimes these very antioxidants can fuel cancer metabolism. So again, let's have some lateral thinking here, and get our heads around some of the, I know it's going to be a little bit heavy for some people, perhaps if they're not really science-minded, but Dr. Pete will hopefully outline the questions that I put to him so far as the physiology and the chemistry of what we call the redox system in the body, the reduction oxidation processes that are so important and necessary for regular cell functioning to occur. And then once we elucidate the redox activity within the body, we can also understand better some of the novel approaches to cancer treatment. So what is it, what it is that we thought we understood about cancer and antioxidants, for example, and in what context then does the latest understanding shed new light on the subject? So firstly, Dr. Pete, thanks so much for joining us again. Hi, Dr. Pete.
Hi, I'm here.
No problem. Okay. So as always, just to introduce yourself, your professional academic background, to give people who perhaps have never listened to you before an understanding of where your research merits are.
Okay. 1968, I had been studying more or less independently biology and a lot of related fields, but 1968, I decided to go to graduate school for a PhD, and graduated there in 1972, specializing in reproductive aging and oxidative changes. And it was the oxidative metabolism that I saw changing with aging, which was really against the grain already. At that time, I saw an increase of reductive activity with aging. For example, you can put a dye in young tissue and old tissue, and reductive enzymes fueled by the energy-producing system and the internal antioxidant system is part of it. The older tissue reduced the dye much more energetically, looking like it was more alive. For example, you can test the vitality of any tissue by the intensity of staining of this tetrazoleum chemical. And I found that an overdose of estrogen or deficiency of vitamin E or any serious injury such as x-rays will increase the ability of the tissue to stain this dye.
Mm-hmm.
So aging and these various injuries all increased the reductive activity of the tissue, which involves what are called the antioxidative enzyme defense systems. And that was what got me interested in the fact that cancer is very rich in antioxidative defenses. Not only the enzymes, but a lot of specific chemicals that will act as antioxidants. At that time, people were trying to identify the specific chemicals that cancers used to defend themselves against oxidative poisons, the chemotherapy, and radiation oxidative damage. But over the last 40 years, it has developed that it isn't just a simple chemical that they produce defensively, but the very basic life processes are shifted in that direction, which increases the reductive or antioxidative staining of this tetrazolium and dye, just as an indicator that's easy to see.
Okay. So what caught my attention reading some of these articles recently was that there's definitely a new novel way of looking at cells. I know you've mentioned this in the past, prior to doing this show, which is kind of more based on the new findings in the extracellular matrix, as they call it, and the fluidity within which cells are mobile and constantly in motion. I think it was always posited before that everything was fairly fixed, and once a cell had differentiated, it couldn't do anything more. Its fate was sealed. But actually, the new theories and new studies are finding that there's much more of a kind of quantum state going on, where things are very fluid and cells very much communicate in two directions and are subject to and give instructions to other components in the body. So in terms of what they call this extracellular matrix, in which the cells kind of reside, what implications does this have for understanding an approach to cancer treatment, for example?
Well, the rigid doctrine of the organism that governs current cancer therapy, it really was imposed on a more basic biological view that started around 1830 with Johannes Müller in Germany, who described tumors as a problem of organization, not of defective cells.
Right.
And that approach has it continued through embryology right through the 1930s and 1940s, in which people could dissociate an embryo or a primitive organism and show that the cells themselves could reconstruct the organism after they had been entirely separated. So the environment that they live in is constantly being constructed to meet their needs. The cells have particular needs, and they will change the environment to meet those needs if they have the energy and the resources. If for some reason a cell or an organ becomes idle, it loses its sense of direction. If there's no stimulation and no energy flowing through the system, the cell doesn't have any particular occupation or knowledge of what it should be doing. But ordinary cells, everything else being ideal, will, if they see a defect in their environment, they will reach out and correct the defect. Mm-hmm. Extracellular matrix, the main components are collagen for stiffness, rigid, linear molecules that twist around each other. In between those stiff collagen molecules, there are carbohydrate chains, polysaccharides, some with proteins attached, but some just simple polysaccharides with amino groups on them that retain water and create an elastic or springy environment against the pure hard environment of the pure collagen system. And cells prefer a certain rigidity of environment. When you take an isolated cell and put it on a surface that varies in stiffness, the cells will creep towards the stiffer, firmer footing. They don't like squishy things to sit on.
Uh-huh.
And if you inject broken down collagen fibers into an organism or a developing embryo, the cells will rearrange the disorganized collagen that you have given them. They're sort of like bricklayers.
Reorganizing.
They will align it in the direction they want and tug on it and communicate partly just by the way they tug, and the other cells sense the tugging and pull back. And
because they have an inherent knowledge of the structure in which they should be in.
Yeah, and they like it fairly solid, but they can create more of the polysaccharide so that it holds more water and is open and able to diffuse things to feed them.
Right.
So it has to be just right. And there are various specific proteins that they secrete to attach themselves to do that pulling and pushing. But there are some proteins at the surface which happen to be chemically connected and interactive with the very structure of the cell all the way through in a very coherent, unifying way. The sulfur and sulfhydryl system of the cell is what gives it much of its toughness. And it has to be constantly broken down and reformed because the cell inside is constantly in motion.
So you're saying that there's a constant connection of sulfhydryl from the outside of the cell to the center of the cell?
Yeah. And about 40 years ago, some experimenters found that if they blocked those surface sulfur groups, the cell couldn't stick to its environment. So the degree of reduction and oxidation of the surface sulfur groups is a very big part of how it sticks to its environment and gets where it has to be and helps to shape its environment.
Right.
And that degree of oxidation is governed by what has been called the antioxidant defense system.
Huh. Okay. All right. You're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMED Garberville, 91.1 FM, and from 7:30 until the end of the show. People are invited to call in with any questions they may have regarding this month's subject of thinking outside the box for cancer therapy. Now, Dr. Pete, here in a bit here, we'll get into the specifics of how reduction oxidation works in cells and how the new findings are showing that actually the concept of antioxidants are not necessarily positive, and how perhaps we can influence that system to be more beneficial towards resolving cancers. I'm also going to be bringing up a article, a very interesting article that everyone can go to the internet and take a look at, written by Mina Bissell on the programs called TED Talks. Basically, there's a 15-minute talk on the architecture and context, the form and function of the organization of the cell, and how cancers are viewed in a different light now. And she's had some pretty exciting results. So, Dr. Pete, in terms of the we mentioned very briefly the reduction and oxidation of cells, or components of cells or molecules that are part of, say, electron transport chain or modifying chemicals. Can you describe this, how this potential works in the matrix, how this can determine the outcome of disease and health? I guess from making the simplistic consumption of antioxidants, for example, a bad choice, perhaps, for cancer strategy.
If you look at the balance between oxidants and antioxidants or reductants,
right,
in the cell, many people think of it as a reducing environment or an antioxidative environment. But when you look at specific components, such as the molecule that transfers electrons from glucose, for example, to the mitochondrion to be oxidized. NAD is the coenzyme, and it becomes reduced to NADH, which is the source of the antioxidant electrons. And if you look at the healthy cell, the ratio of the oxidized form is hundreds of times the reduced form is about 500 or more times the oxidized form is 500 times greater than the reduced form.
Okay.
And so that's the governing antioxidant.
Is the oxidized form.
It's in a highly oxidized state. And that is in balance with ascorbic acid and coenzyme Q10 and vitamin E and the sulfur system, glutathione and glutathione disulfide. These are all energized by the electron from NADH, which comes from glucose normally.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cell normally is in this really highly oxidized state, as determined by the ratio of NAD to NADH.
Okay.
And if the cell is sick, for example, a cancer cell, the ratio approaches 1:1.
Wow.
It's almost 50% in the reduced antioxidant state.
Wow.
And if you injure a cell, you turn on this signaling system that James Watson talked about as one of the problems, that he says people are looking for some way to turn that off so you don't keep pushing the cell in the direction of too much reduction. But in fact, anything that irritates the cell is likely to turn on more of the reducing system and push it in that direction of stress or cancer, with a high ratio of NADH to NAD, approaching 1:1.
But you're saying that you want it in a oxidized form. You want the cell not to have access to antioxidant activity.
Yeah, the healthy active cell has about 500 times more of the oxidized NAD.
Okay.
And when the people who are selling their very powerful antioxidants, a lot of the advertisements say it's many times more powerful than vitamin C or than vitamin E.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're doing is testing the antioxidants in vitro in a test tube.
Right.
And they will attack and destroy the oxidizing fragments, free radicals. But it happens that just like the NADH couple, which is highly oxidized, the things in balance with that ascorbic acid and vitamin E, for example,
right,
inside the cell, they become oxidized. Dehydroascorbic acid is an oxidant, and it's 8 times more concentrated in the cell than outside. It's relatively hydrophobic, and it goes to the oily parts of the cell.
So that will itself break down an antioxidant from on the outside of the cell.
When you're irritating the cell and turning on the defensive antioxidant reductive systems and producing a lot of the fragments that reduce glutathione, one of the sulfur molecules that exchanges throughout the system. When the cell is irritated, that and the associated ascorbic acid, which becomes reduced, and the vitamin E, which becomes reduced, these will sop up the toxic fragments. But the trouble is that the system, which normally should be oxidized all the way through the ascorbic acid, vitamin C, vitamin E, coenzyme Q10, and so on,
mm-hmm.
The whole system gets stuck in an over-reduced, over-electrified
right.
form, not enough oxidation going on
right.
to pull it back where it should be. And since the 1930s, people have seen that any cell which is dividing goes into this highly reduced state in which everything shifts to the sulfhydryl rather than the disulfide form.
Okay, and this includes the cancer cells then?
Normal cells go into this phase very quickly, divide, and mm-hmm. then return to their oxidized state.
Right.
And the vitamin E and vitamin C go back to becoming oxidants and keeping the system tightened up, helping to squeeze water out of the system. And the balance where the membrane potential of a cell is normally around 100 millivolts difference when you measure it with an electrode stuck into it.
Mm-hmm.
The redox difference is in a range of about 15 millivolts, a very small fraction of the energy which is available for reduction. If you measure the voltage between glucose and oxygen, it's over a volt. So it's about 100 times more than the difference of 15 millivolts, which governs practically all of the reactions in the cell. The enzymes which produce energy, synthesize protein, which govern the economy of the cell, these are sensitive to being reduced or oxidized. And so this 15 millivolt difference mm-hmm. can shift the whole
right.
economy of the cell.
I suppose it's a pretty tight range within which normality exists.
Yeah, and when you measure the products, such as pyruvic acid versus lactic acid, these are an excreted or easily extracted index of the oxidative or reductive mm-hmm. state of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the cell is in trouble, it turns pyruvic acid into lactic acid by reducing it. So that's a reflection of the highly reduced antioxidant state when the cell is distressed and making lactic acid.
Right.
When oxygen is working properly,
right.
it's not producing lactic acid, it's consuming the pyruvic acid, turning it into carbon dioxide. So the ratio between not only pyruvic acid and lactic acid, but overall it would be between lactic acid versus carbon dioxide.
Okay.
Carbon dioxide is an acid, and so in a sense it's an oxidant. It causes retraction of electrons.
Because the fundamental here is basically mopping up electrons.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. The reactive oxygen species, okay, so are a group of molecules governed electrically. The antioxidant system versus the reactive oxygen species system. In terms of inflammation and what free radicals, I think, as I've understood, free radical damage to be a result of, you know, free radical liberation that isn't mopped up by antioxidants. Is it almost that free radicals are almost, I almost think of free radicals now as being a little more beneficial than the antioxidants because they,
That's Watson's interpretation, but I think
that's
that
not correct.
Of his 50 years as a reductionist, when he comes out of the static mechanical view of genetics and looks at the metabolism of the cell, he tends to over concretize, and the antioxidant system is doing good stuff, defending against toxic free radicals, but the oxidative normal functions involving ascorbic acid or dehydroascorbate and vitamin E and the sulfhydryl balancing system, those are able to control the system that he suggests the toxic free radicals.
Right.
Would be doing.
Right.
And so you can get both the good defensive process against free radicals and the limiting of the production of more free radicals without resorting to one of the toxic chemicals that he's suggesting.
Right. Because you're advocating, and I know you have not just for the subject in hand, but in general, as a good health practice from advocating plenty of fruit consumption, for example, you advocate vitamin C and vitamin E as very safe and gentle, relatively gentle in their antioxidant capacity to some of the products I know that have been mentioned. You talk about the super antioxidants that are touted on the supplement market that people may want to may have consumed or may have thought were a good thing. But in general, vitamin C and vitamin E are very safe and they do the work very effectively.
That's because they are electrically tuned to exactly a certain role or group of roles in the cell.
Yeah.
And if you put in a dynamite instead of alcohol, you can have the same overall energy expense, but it isn't under control.
Right.
And some of the antioxidants that they're selling are more like dynamite.
Right.
Don't fit into the system, and so they aren't helpful at all.
Hmm.
And when the good antioxidants are working properly, the system can run as fast as it wants, practically, oxidizing at full speed. And there are examples of experiments in which as you add thyroid hormone or a chemical that uncouples the production of ATP from simply the burning of oxygen and fuel, as you rev up the oxidizing process, you get fewer and fewer free radical productions.
Hmm.
So,
okay. Because you normally associate free radical production with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the good antioxidants are working with the mitochondria.
Right, safely.
And the faster that system runs, the fewer electrons get away to cause the dangerous free radicals.
So this is a bit like the aerobic versus anaerobic glycolysis and its effects.
When the cell gets out of control, oxygen is no longer able to suck up the electrons, and so the cell has to expel the electrons in the form of lactic acid.
Right.
And
right.
That's a survival mechanism, but it happens that when you do that, the desperate production of lactic acid to draw off excess electrons. It happens to raise the pH inside the cell and lower the pH outside the cell. And I think it was the embryologist Holtfrater who demonstrated that if you put an embryo in a slightly acidified solution, the cells simply leave the embryo and float off and do their own thing.
Okay.
And so the cancer or the stress metabolism acidifying outside the cell is tending to destroy the cell's connection to its environment, and at the same time raising the pH inside the cell makes it swell up, take up water, and shifts the self-hydral balance into the reduced state, and tends to turn on constant cell division.
Okay, well, I guess before we get into the Danopoulos previous experiments and research with urea for the treatment of cancers, including that of liver cancer, I know that from an oxidant versus antioxidant perspective, that exercise in its own right then generates sufficient biological oxidants, which could be perhaps used as a valid approach to diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and some cancers. And I've seen that there is some research to support that they exercise, especially for diabetes, but in some instances for cardiovascular disease and cancer is actually fairly pertinent.
Exercise will cause cells to take up glucose in the absence of insulin, mm-hmm. and will make them operate effectively, but just like the uncoupling protein or the increased thyroid, these are the cells' equivalents of exercise, so that when everything is working in an organized way, the cells are exercising by simply burning oxygen and fuel and warming themselves up. So exercise should keep everything active, but when it doesn't, the organism can defend itself and imitate exercise by running things at a higher speed.
Okay. All right, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Galveville 91.1 FM. From now until the end of the show at 8 o'clock, callers are invited to call in with any questions they have, hopefully surrounding tonight's subject of novel approaches to cancer. So like I said at the beginning of the show, we're hopefully going to get into a little bit later on about liver cancer and some of the work done by a pioneering doctor back in the 80s, which is still relevant today, concerning urea therapy. The number, if you live in the area, is 923-3911, or if you live outside the area, there's an 800 number, which is 1-800-KMUD-RAD. So, Dr. Pete, I looked earlier on at that 15-minute well, it wasn't a podcast, but it was a video, basically the TED Talk that Mina Bissell presented. It's a very interesting work that she was doing, and quite amazing, where she had shown that the context and the architecture of the cell was very much the governing force behind whether or not cancers were present. And I know from what you were mentioning earlier on about the extracellular matrix of the whole solution around the cell, within the cell, is all very fluid. The cytoskeleton is all starts from the outside and works its way in. It's constant, and the energy that should be present within a healthy cell gives the potential to signal and to allow changes to happen, so that everything's ordered. Now, what she was bringing up was, I think she was specializing in breast cancer, and she'd showed that clip during the 15-minute speech that she gave about the duct cell, one of the duct cells that secretes milk. It was a precancerous stage, and then a cancerous stage, and then she basically proved that it could be, the cancerous cell could get turned back to its normal state, not by poisoning it or radiating it, but by allowing the extracellular matrix in which it was growing to be normalized. And I know this is an approach that you're positing now as a novel way of approaching a disease in general, not just cancers, but other diseases. So that it's more of a functional disorganization of the environment in which the cells operate that is the cause, rather than the cells themselves becoming mutant or aberrant or just losing their program or whatever is popular vogue theory for, you know, health.
The exercise idea is very relevant to breast cancer. You've probably heard the statistics that women who are constantly having babies and nursing mm-hmm. Through their whole fertile years have a very low risk of breast cancer.
Right, right.
And so what is working keeps working.
Mm-hmm.
And the cells which are have a load and a job to do are keeping their extracellular matrix organized
right.
to support what they're doing.
We do have a caller. I want to get this caller very quickly, but I do also want to ask you whether or not, how much credence do you think the high exposure to progesterone during pregnancy has on that fact that they have very low incidence of breast cancer? How much of that part do you think it plays?
I think that's the main thing. It erases. For example, looking at connective tissue, like the tendons, which are almost pure connective tissue, if you expose a rabbit, for example, to estrogen, the connective tissue, such as the tendon, becomes stiff and hardened.
Right.
And every time it becomes pregnant and the estrogen goes up, you see a shift momentarily towards hardening, but after each pregnancy, it's less hardened than before, and it's the progesterone which reverses those changes, even in the connective tissue, the extracellular matrix, and it's also erasing the intracellular estrogen functions, the synthesis of estrogen, failure to detoxify it, and tendency to bind it. All of these are regulated by progesterone as an anti-estrogen.
Good. Okay, well, let's get this caller then and see where this caller's question is going. Hi, caller. You're on the air, and where are you from?
Hi, Dr. Pete. And Andrew, you and I have spoken over computer stuff, and my question is, I was born with some interesting genetics, and I've always wondered how it happened that I was born from two eggs. And I have lots of things because of that, both genders because of that. And I wondered, how did that happen?
Dr. P, I think your condition is chimerism, isn't it? You are a chimera, as far as I remember. I don't know. I think the caller might have hung up, actually. But Dr. Pete, chimeras, I think they're extremely rare in the population.
The embryologists have made them. And you can that's one of the early demonstrations that mutations aren't the cause of cancer. Somatic mutation theory was made defunct 40 years ago when someone took a cell from a tumor and stuck it in an early embryo. The tumor came from, I think it was a black hamster, and they put it in the embryo from a white hamster. Both of his parents were white. And the developing organism had four parents.
Mm-hmm.
It was a mixture of white and black inheritance, showing that what had been a cancer cell developed into an ordinary part of the organism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of thing that on a more highly differentiated tissue that mean abyssal is demonstrating, that it's the environment, not the genes, which make a cancer.
So, what do you do you have anything to say about chimeras in the human population and how they come about, or how rare? We know they're rare.
I think they're probably not as extremely rare as one would suppose, because the the early embryos, if they happen to get too close, it's very easy for them to mix and form one organism.
Mm-hmm. Because people can have two or more blood types. Their red blood cells can express the markers for, you know, O positive and rhesus groups, or B, you know, it could be B rhesus negative in the same person.
I found
that quite fascinating. Okay, well let's move on then. Look out. I think there's another caller. Let's take this next caller before we move on. Hi, caller. You're on the air. Where are you from? Yeah. Okay. I think this is some part of what we'll hopefully get resolved.
We did have another caller who really wanted to ask Dr. Pete something, if I could use this opportunity.
Sure.
He wanted to know about low-carb diets, the fat-burning ketone diet, and specifically, he said it's helped him quite a bit. He wanted to know what Dr. Pete thought about that, ketone diet.
Yeah. What do you think of that, Dr. Pete?
You don't produce the ketones unless you're raising your cortisol enough to activate the conversion of protein into the ketones, to activate the conversion of protein into glucose at the same time you're turning some of the fat into ketones.
So it's a pretty stressful...
And I think the problem occurs over a few years of exposure to that increased breakdown of protein. The cortisol is affecting your connective tissues,
mm-hmm.
and the explorer, I don't remember his name at the moment, Arctic explorer who advocated a meat diet,
mm-hmm.
He noticed that Eskimos were very prematurely aged in appearance. Their skin became very wrinkled.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you would expect from being exposed to very high cortisol constantly.
Right. So the ketone diet is a pretty stressful way to do anything like lose weight, and losing weight in general is not a very good idea unless it's done slowly, especially in people that have lots of stored polyunsaturates in their fat makeup, which is most people, unless they're really watching what they eat and avoiding polyunsaturates and making sure they consume lots of saturated fats. Actually, it's a very I want to make a very quick point here. I was back in England 3 weeks ago for a couple of weeks, and on my way out of the airport, I grabbed a couple of periodicals to read while I was on the plane. I got a New Scientific and I got the Daily Telegraph, and on the cover of the New Scientist, it had a picture of a frying pan and the word FACT. The C was a piece of carbonized bacon, and the F and the A and the T of the word fact were still intact. And so what you saw was fat with a carbonized piece of bacon forming the C, but it was blackened against the black background of the frying pan. And it said, "Have we really got 40 years of dietary advice wrong?" And it was actually a good breath of fresh air, another one of the breaths that hopefully wake people up enough when they get enough these fresh breaths coming in, that to say that they were very much behind especially dairy saturated fat, and that all saturated fat in general was very good for you, and that the polyunsaturates and the margarines and the fish oils are actually being shown now to be turned on their head, and they were actually saying, "Yep, we think we've got 40 years of dietary advice wrong." So that was good to see. And then the other sad point that I did see in the Daily Telegraph was that in England they're now running GM crops, and when I left England in 2001, they were actually, Europe was all GMO free. So now in England, they're actually making a GMO crop to express omega-3 oils so that they can feed this crop to GM salmon that are grown in the environment that doesn't allow them to pick up the polyunsaturate from the algae and the microorganisms that they eat. So they're now going to feed them a GM crop expressing omega-3s. I can't believe it. So not too sure what's happening, folks, but I know California is still on the cutting edge, I think, of trying to see sideways here with our food and environment and everything else that's going on. So hopefully between the West Coast and the East Coast of the States, we can keep this kind of thing going and alive. So anyway, Dr. P, I wanted to bring up Dr. Danopoulos's his work with urea therapy from the 80s. I know I had a caller some time ago that I got personally who was looking for some help and information regarding liver cancer. And I know Danopoulos had done quite a bit of work in 1980, published in Clinical Oncology, about an 11-year experience using oral urea treatment in liver malignancies. How familiar are you with urea as a compound for the treatment of carcinomas or other, you know, cancers?
In the First World War, it was used as an emergency treatment to stimulate healing in wounds, mm-hmm. and hold down infections.
Okay.
And around that time, 1920s, I think it was often used for inoperable cancer to pack it with urea to, it actually was not only keeping down infection, but I think it was actually having a healing influence. And the effect of forming lactic acid that I mentioned,
right.
Which causes the pH of the cell to become more alkaline inside, that causes swelling, and swelling promotes replication, proliferation,
mm-hmm.
and simply an osmotic environment, which could be very concentrated sodium chloride or urea, happens to be a very innocuous substance. It doesn't exactly have an osmotic effect like sodium chloride,
mm-hmm.
because the sodium is kept out of the cell,
right.
But the urea acts somewhat like an osmotic dehydrator. It helps to prevent excess swelling and water retention.
So you think that's one of its main effects, and that's how it's keeping swelling down?
I think so.
Huh. Okay.
And the dehydrated cell becomes more oxidatively active and catabolic, burning fuel faster, where the swollen cell is anabolic and simply growing and dividing. So many things can help to reduce that water retention. I think urea would work well with a good thyroid program, which helps you to retain the normal amount of sodium chloride. Hypothyroid people not only produce the matrix, which is overhydrated, it shifts the cells so that they produce molecules that hold water outside of cells. But the low thyroid function lets your kidneys lose sodium while retaining water. And so any of the osmotic therapies such as urea, I think, would work nicely with supplementing thyroid to normalize the sodium retention.
Mm. Good. All right, we do have a couple of callers on the air, so I should start by taking one of these, the first caller. You're on the air, caller. Where are you from?
Dr. P?
Yes?
Yes, I, you know, and this is, I guess, a little off topic, but in a way it's not. When you're describing these processes, I mean, you do it so beautifully, and it seems very complicated, but are you actually seeing images? Like, do you actually see these processes? And I know, of course, a lot of this probably has not been photographed through microscopic techniques and different things. So are you just, in a way, integrating all this information and seeing things?
I see little models. Not that I've seen anything exactly like it, but I have mental models, for example, of the extension of the sulfhydryl groups onto the surface of a cell. I have very concrete pictures of how that works, and so it helps me when I'm looking for information to check against the published research facts to have a concrete mental image.
Yeah, and the reason I'm asking that question is you were explaining like the collagen lining up and all, and a lot of times when I'm reading your work, I find myself trying to imagine these things, and then I'm thinking that's got to be an important part of your process in trying to imagine, since you're a painter, visual images of how this actually might look. Is that true?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've always been aware of having a map of where I'm going. And I was surprised in graduate school when a psychology professor was surprised at my description. And I asked him how he found his way from his home to his office. And he said, go out the front door, turn left again, turn right. And it was all a set of rules. And I think some professorial types actually think in terms of words and rules.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and the other thing I thought about in line with you know, the like almost visualizations of how this works is, you know, through the years I've heard of different healers and people that, you know, are more new agey kind of things where they try to get people to imagine certain things and then try to heal it. But then I started thinking, if you were really seeing this like you're seeing it, you really could, in a way, be a part of the healing process in that you're seeing what's wrong and you're seeing what you need to do to fix it. You know what I mean?
We were talking about the different theories of what a cancer is. The new theory, it's called Taft tissue organization field theory, and I think that needs another adjective, organismic. It isn't just the local tissue organization, but it's also the way that tissue fits into the whole organism and how the activity of the organism keeps everything working. Loading all of its parts so that they know what they're doing.
It's very much the, and I don't want to make a quip here, but it's very much the holistic way of looking at it. And that's what I found was so interesting with, even though it may not have been totally accurate, Dr. Watson's comments that we made earlier, and also this kind of novel approach to cancer treatment through the looking at the extracellular matrix as very much a holistic environment upon which every cell is in communication with every other cell. Stem cells are arising all the time, and actually nothing is fixed. Everything is very fluid and dynamic and very much able to change very quickly.
Yeah, individual cells, for example, pigment cells, you can sometimes see them migrating through the tissue, and they move at the same rate that cells have been found to be able to crawl on a glass slide. And that at body temperature, that can be something like a centimeter and a half per day.
Uh-huh.
A very tiny cell really zips along through the solid seeming tissue.
Far out. Well, listen, I think we better probably wrap. There's two callers on the air, but we're not going to be able to take them, unfortunately. It's 3 minutes to the top of the hour. And once again, we've kind of run out of time. But let me just let people know how to find out more about you, Dr. Pete. And thanks so much for joining.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so once again, unfortunately, sorry for those callers who perhaps wanted to ask questions but didn't manage to get through in time. Dr. Ray Pete is a wealth of experience and a wealth of resources available and freely shared on the internet. His website is www.raypeat.com. Most of his, well, all of his articles, no, it's not most, but all of his articles are referenced, so it's not just his opinion, what he's read, what he thinks. There's lots of references to the work that's been done, pioneering work by people that unfortunately we don't hear often enough, that don't make the mainstream. But there are times when people like Mina Bissell, and all the other people that Dr. Pete just brings to the show in terms of the pioneers that have done the work that we're talking about, very much make the contributions that are thinking outside the box. And it's that thinking outside the box that really fundamentally changes everything from what we do to what we eat. And the whole quantum mechanics thing is also another very exciting field that's making the seemingly impossible possible. So, yeah, go take a look at his website. There's lots of articles ranging from diabetes to saturated fats versus polyunsaturated, cancer, dementia, inflammation, thyroid. His specialties are hormones, reproductive hormones, and aging hormones. So very interesting work there. Lots of it is very scientific, but it's also very readable. For those of you who have joined us this evening, thanks so much for listening.